Today is Monday, December 14th, 2020. This is part 8 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Pat Gredigan, spelled G-R-E-D-I-A-G-I-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good evening, Pat. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Great. Pat, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. In part 7, you talked about getting a job as a chief river ranger at Dinosaur National Monument in the spring, early summer of 1998. And you talked a little bit about how different Dinosaur was from Big Bend as far as kind of everybody sort of being isolated, not a lot of camaraderie, I guess, amongst the people that work there, like happened at Big Bend.
Yeah, that's right.
And so we kind of covered that ground. I wondered if you could describe for me your take on you know, the rivers there in Dinosaur National Monument, the Yampa, Y-A-M-P-A, and the Gates of Lodore, L-O-D-O-R-E, and Split Mountain, S-P-L-I-T.
Sure. Well, I'll just do a real brief description of both of those rivers and then a description of the my job a little bit more and then some of the trips that I did.
Great.
So Lodore is the name of the canyon that the Green River flows through after it exits Flaming Gorge Dam upstream, I don't know what, 40 miles, something like that, maybe 50. So it's dam controlled. And the Yampa River comes out of Colorado and is wild, going into through the park, and it joins the Green River in the middle of Dinosaur. And from there downstream, it's all the Green River, which ultimately goes into Canyonlands, where I had worked previously in the 80s.
Cool.
The dam controls the flow of Lodore, so there's always a dam control flow. Sometimes it's low, but there's always that flow. Whereas the Yampa goes up with the spring runoff out of the mountains, peaking usually in late May or early June. I think it might be more common in June. And then it drops down to where in July it becomes essentially too low to run. The park had lotteries for getting permits to run either of those sections. And usually people would continue on those trips on down the Green through Split Mountain and take out at the downstream in the Split Mountain, which was over near the quarry area. So by middle of July, very few people were on the Yampa because essentially it was not enough water to run rafts down and raft trips. I did do a low water trip after, well, I don't know what, it must have been in July sometime, but the water was too low for rafts.
Uh-huh.
And a friend and I, she was a volunteer and accompanied on a patrol, and I took a canoe. And I just canoed down it, and she had, I don't know if she had an inflatable kayak, I can't remember, but it was real interesting to me to go down and see that, one, it could be a pleasant enough river trip at low water,
yep.
And then to see what the differences were when you see Warm Springs Rapid, which is the largest one, with low water.
I don't know if you're going to talk about it later, but I'll definitely want to know more about that low water trip because that is becoming much more popular these days.
Yeah, a little light bulb went off in my head at that time as also a private. I like to go on river trips on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, I still like to. And I always thought, well, yeah, that's a great way to be able to go down the Yampa River after the official season has closed. The park is no longer regulating, or there's not a lottery to get permits to launch you still would need to get a permit, but it's not, you're not competing with so many people because most people hadn't been interested in doing those low water trips at that time.
That's right.
Just to finish the description of that trip, we took out Echo Park because we weren't ready to go through Split Mountain, which would have more volume of water in it because of the water the Green River contributed. And I just wasn't ready to go through that in the canoe. So we took out Echo Park, which is just where the two rivers come together and the road comes down to that point.
Right. But I suppose you could have gone through Whirlpool Canyon and down to Browns Park? No, it's not Browns Park. What's the name of it?
Through Rainbow Island Park.
Island Park, thank you, which is right at the top of Split Mountain and take out there.
Right. Hmm. Yep, that would have been doable.
Okay.
Or it would be doable for a private boaters who were not commercial or not government to go down and do that kind of trip on the low water.
Yeah, I was just thinking about a canoe. Just what could a canoe handle comfortably?
Right.
If you didn't want to do Split Mountain because, you know, it's a little sportier in there.
Right.
Certainly getting to Island Park would be a wonderful little, you know,
I think it would be
summer, late summer, early fall trip.
Yeah, I've thought about doing that again sometime, but I haven't. I think that there's water that gets drawn out of the Yampa for irrigation, and I don't know if there might be a point to which it gets to be, you know, unrunnable in the canoe. I could see that it potentially could. I don't remember that. I think it was late in my tenure. Well, I was at Dinosaur for 3 years, and I think it was towards the end of that I did this canoe trip, but I can't off the top of my head remember. Anyway, there's possibilities for doing that. I'm not sure you could just go any old time, but especially after irrigation season ended, oftentimes river volumes will go back up again once the irrigators are not taking water out.
Right, before the ice comes, and of course the whole Canyon River freezes over solid in the winter. But in the fall, okay.
So I had... I was in charge of the River Ranger patrols, and Dinosaur was, each of the parks that I had worked in where I had rivers had different seasons because of their location north and south.
Okay.
So in Big Bend, there was a lot of early spring and into the late fall kinds of trips on the shoulder seasons. And in Dinosaur, it was mostly just a May, June, July, August, September on the through the Lador kind of season. It was your classic summer running river seasons, and that's where we would hire two river seasonals, worked on the river. So I did more supervising than river rangering myself there.
Okay.
I supervised the two river rangers who did the patrols. Then we had rangers stationed at the put-in at Deer Lodge, on where people would put in to run the Yampa, and at Lador, which is where people would put in to run through Lador Canyon. And then we had a ranger stationed at Echo Park, which is right near where those two rivers come together. And then downstream from there, essentially the part that was in the Utah part of the park, all that I've described was in the Colorado side. The park straddles the Utah and Colorado boundary, with parts of the park in both on both sides, and downstream, and actually I think it's technically a monument still. Or did it get switched to a park?
Still a monument.
It's still a monument, right. So I use the term park technically incorrectly. It was a national monument and still is. But both sides of the monument, on the Utah side was another district ranger who was supervised the seasonals that worked both in the campground near the quarry, but she also had, and those rangers would sometimes go to the takeout for the river trips and just make sure people were orderly about using the ramp space, and they would swing by up at the launch point for you could just do a day trip through Split Mountain. And so those rangers handled that physical end of the river trips because that was over in the Utah side and they could access it from where they lived.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. From Vernal, basically.
Right. From Jensen and Vernal side, yeah.
Got it.
And
okay.
There was park housing over there near the quarry. There was some park housing near the headquarters just outside of Dinosaur, but not that much. So there wasn't as much of a staff on that side as I remember.
Okay.
So we were busy with river operations during those. Actually, every now, I think we did usually one patrol in April, one or two in May, and then through the summer. And I can't remember if we went into October or not. But when all the seasonals were gone, because the summer season was over for the busy river use, then that pretty much just left me to be doing patrols through the Colorado side of the park. And I wouldn't do river patrols, but I would do vehicle patrols into the backcountry on the Colorado side. So there's a road that goes along the Yampa Bench.
Yeah.
Up above the Yampa River itself, there was a private landowner who had a lease to run cows inside the park that was grandfathered in when the monument was, I think, expanded from the small quarry where it started from.
Right.
So we had some cows that were grazing on monument lands. And then if you went sort of in that wedge of land that's between the Yampa and Lador, kind of on the northeast aspect of the monument.
Right.
There wasn't good access in there, but there was a fire tower, a lookout there called Zenobia. And there was some access into some grasslands that elk would graze in the park there. And that was I think that's where there was a local who illegally took hunters into the park before I ever got there. And it might have been 10 years before, maybe 5 years before. And he got busted for doing that by Fish and Wildlife Service, who somehow got wind of this and had an undercover guy go in as just posing as a hunter. And he videotaped all these people shooting in the park.
Wow.
And so I knew that this guy was still living out in that corner of the park and was no friend of the park. So I would patrol out there as well as on the Yampa Bend. So there was land masses that were in my portion of the park. And there was really no one else in the winter months to be doing any of that patrolling, and so I did, which was kind of an interesting change of pace from being focused on the river and the river use.
Gorgeous country out there.
And it was gorgeous. Yeah, it was a great chance to see some stuff that most people never get to see. Dinosaur had some of the most beautiful landscapes. Of course, it's mostly known to most people for the Dinosaur Quarry, which is on the western side of the park in the Utah part, and where they have a lot of fossils that are exhibited in place in the cliffs,
mm-hmm.
where they were partially uncovered. But the whole Colorado part was just a great wild western landscape with beautiful rivers going through it and low visitation in general. So it was a real treat to be working there.
Hey, Pat, the Zenobia lookout tower, is that Zonoba?
It's Zenobia, and so I think it's Zenobia. Zenobia.
Zenobia. Okay. Do you know the mountain range that area is? Is that the Jewel Mountains, or is there a name for them out there?
I don't really remember what they might have been called. There is some high country there. I know that there was an old, I think it was called like the Horse Thief Trail or something like that. There's some history from the late 80s of cattle ranching up in Browns Park. And I'm talking from memory here.
In the 1880s.
In the 1880s, right.
Yeah.
The Bassetts were up there.
Okay.
And I think the Butch Cassidy and his gang came through there. And there supposedly was a route that came along the east side of Lodore in that high country was Zenobia Peak is.
Huh.
And dropped down into and crossed the Yampa River maybe within a couple miles of the confluence, as I remember.
Really? Interesting.
I can't remember exactly where it supposedly came down.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would have gone, I think, into, well, maybe they came out up under the bench out of one of those side canyons down in there. Or maybe they went to Echo Park. I can't remember. But
right.
Then they could exit down towards Jensen. And one of the Bassett daughters ended up living in a cabin there, which is now in the monument. It was Josie. I don't know if you remember Josie's cabin there at the end of the road. If you're going to the dinosaur quarry, you can continue driving. You end up at a cabin there, and that was Josie Bassett's cabin.
Huh, no.
He was part of that Bassett family that had been up in Browns Park. And
okay.
Anyway, there's just a lot of Western history that was in that area, and I think there was a route of travel from what I remember hearing through that Zenobia Peak area, but I don't remember what that highland was called other than that one peak.
And I also wanted to ask you, I may be jumping ahead a little bit, but there was a ranger, he might have been a seasonal ranger, named Bill Ott. Does that name ring a bell?
No. You know what? I knew a Marty Ott. And when you said Bill Ott, my brain was trying to put it together. But
okay.
I wonder if I ever, do you remember what time he was there? I don't know him well.
He's passed away now, but he fixed up the a little sad iron boat there, the cataract boat, and took it on patrols as an interpretive talk about piece for the Halliseys and Reynolds that were doing boating in there in the 50s, commercial boating.
Huh.
And it's in the auditorium there in the visitor center now, not at the quarry, but over at the headquarters area.
Yeah, I remember the boat now, but I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember him, and that might have been probably before my time there.
That would make sense. Okay, I was just thinking. Oh, wait a minute! I should ask you about Bill Ott.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, don't know of him.
But yeah, beautiful landscape. And so in the winter, you would be patrolling. Were you basically the only law enforcement ranger for the Colorado side of the entire monument?
Yes. Yes. In the winter, I was.
Wow.
There was the chief ranger. Dave Panabaker, Panebaker, I think. His office was on the Colorado side.
Okay.
So in theory, but he didn't do patrols, but he was somebody I could say, Dave, I need some help. And 2 hours later, he'd show up. That kind of
okay.
thing. It's a big country. But we also had relationships with the county sheriff. They would have been miles away, too. So you just had to keep in mind that there really wasn't anybody else around, and you needed to, first of all, I didn't really see that many people. Although the potential was there for hunters to be in the park or for me to catch up with this guy that had illegally hunted in the park. And indeed, I did catch up with him. One spring day, maybe in March, in that access area where you might go in near to Zenobia, kind of the northeast face coming in from that direction of the monument, so the elk would shed their antlers inside the monument, and it was illegal to go gather them up. But some people would gather them because they could sell them for I don't know, $10 or $15 a pound, maybe, something
wow.
like that, for ultimate use, I think, in the Chinese medicine market. And so they would go in and haul out antlers to sell.
Okay.
And we knew that that was possibly going on.
Yeah.
And so I was over in that corner at one point and kind of just checking things out, and I saw a car parked where you would park a car to walk in, or a truck to walk into these grasslands where the elk would be. And I wish I could remember the name of that specific part of the park, but I can't. But so I thought, oh, maybe I knew it was his truck or something. I might have radioed and got a read the plate or something like that. But I just became instantly suspicious that somebody was in there picking up antlers.
Hmm.
And so I remember just being very filled with adrenaline because I was like, oh my God, I'm way out here. This could
right.
be somebody that's doing something illegal.
Right.
And I'm by myself, and how am I going to handle this? And so I started following the road in, or the route in, which was an old road. And I don't know if there was tracks or not, and like in partial snow left over, but I was going in to where I thought these people, or this person or people, would be. And I had a handheld radio. The radio in my truck was strong enough to get out to contact somebody, dispatch, but the handheld wasn't strong enough, and I knew that I was not really in a good position to be confronting someone. And so I was very cautious going down this road, and I'd be kind of like stopping and peeking around a corner before I went ahead, because I didn't want to suddenly come upon them and not know what was happening. I wanted to be in control of it. I wanted to know when I was approaching them, not be surprised by it.
Right.
So I was very cautious going in, and then I heard these voices coming towards me, and I remember going off into the side and hiding, you know, behind some trees and stuff, and two people were walking out with antlers strapped to their backpacks, and it was both a like, yes, I caught them, but okay, now what am I going to do with, you know, how am I going
right.
to handle this kind of moment? And I thought about it, and I thought, I'm just going to follow them back discreetly, because at least if I get near my truck, I have a radio there that has I can radio out with, and also the antlers are evidence, and if I confront them here, then I have to haul them out, because now I've taken
Ooh.
Possession of the evidence, and I didn't want to have to haul them all out. So I just kind of stayed back behind them and followed them out and would peek around the corners, you know, to make sure they were still ahead of me, hadn't stopped for some reason that
mm-hmm.
I was going to. And honestly, it reminded me a little bit of being a kid when you're kind of
mm-hmm.
playing cops and robbers when you're a kid and you're hiding behind the tree and peeking around the corner to see if they can see you. And it was kind of fun in a way. But
you're still outnumbered and your radio doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so, okay, I'm like, then what did you do?
Yeah. Well, I just trailed them out, and when we got to the vehicles, I confronted them.
They must have seen your vehicle there.
They must have seen it right when they broke out to the zone where they were, you know, were approaching the vehicles. They must have seen it and gone, oh boy.
Right.
And so I think, I don't have a clear memory of exactly what happened, but it was okay. I got on my part. I said, you know, I didn't say you're under arrest. What I did was give them a citation and take their antlers. So I said, I'm going to cite you for picking up antlers in the park. I got on my radio. I made contact with dispatch, which I don't remember if that would have been a sheriff's patrol dispatch or if there was somebody in our office that was monitoring the radios.
Okay.
But I got a hold of someone and said, this is what I'm doing. This is where I'm at. I issued them. I took their antlers, and they didn't put up a fuss. They were caught, and they weren't happy about it, but they didn't, like, attack me or anything like
right.
that. So I took their antlers. I gave them citations to it was called mandatory citations. They have to show up in court. So rather than just like you've got to pay $20 because you've got government for this or that, it was you have to go to court and the judge is going to hear the case and then the judge will decide what you're going to get fined.
Okay.
So it was a way to get them into court without arresting them or taking them to jail, which was...
Very clever.
That was, yeah. So that's what happened, and they went away, and I went back to headquarters, and my boss was so excited, like, oh, my God, you got him, and, oh, you got the antlers, and we're going to make a great case out of this. And so we prepared our story and our evidence and went to a magistrate court, which is they hear cases that are misdemeanors, not felonies.
Okay.
And so it's more of a local court. It's a federal court, but it was not, it was a magistrate judge. I can't remember.
Right.
The description.
And Grand Canyon has the same.
Yes.
A circuit judge, basically, that comes out and hears cases and
yes.
holds court.
Yes.
And then, you know, heads out and does the rounds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I think they had I can't remember where the court was. It might have been in Craig, Colorado, but wherever it was,
okay.
we, you know, on the appointed day, which the court pretty much sets, I think, we went to court, they showed up, and we presented our evidence, and, you know, they got fined like $700 or something that was a little bit of a sting, but the problem was this is the same guy. I mean, I always felt like, he got away with it in a way because this is the same guy that had been illegally hunting in the park and been busted for it 5 or 8 years earlier. So he's obviously
wow.
someone who doesn't respect the rules
right.
regarding use of the park and was out there again taking advantage of the distance and the fact that it was a very unvisited part of the park to just do whatever he felt like doing in the park.
Right.
And so he did have to pay a fine, but you know it was.
Gosh, you'd think at that point having illegally hunted and then gone back
yeah.
to do this that he would
he would be banned from the park or something.
Yeah. For you know 5 years or some sort of time period.
Right.
You know that's the next thing to do is say sorry you can't. Come here anymore.
Right. Now, here's I don't remember who the magistrate judge was, but I will just say this is western Colorado, northwestern Colorado, where the local sentiment, it's a ranching, hunting community.
Right.
And in their eye, you know, in the whole community's eyes, the whole corner of the state's eyes, that's no big deal.
Right.
You know, picking up some antlers. So it's just a reflection of what the local sentiment was, I believe.
Interesting.
Anyway, that's the way that ended.
Yeah, okay.
So, but most of the time I didn't, you know, I didn't really have, that's the only case I can remember of catching someone doing something during those patrols.
Mm-hmm.
But I would maybe talk to people now and then and just be out there. So part of it is that
right.
local word is that these people are, the rangers are watching. And
just a presence.
Yeah. So, so that was what I would do in the winters and in the summers, do the hiring, the supervising, the making sure that the river patrols got scheduled and following up on whatever they might find. I did some patrols. Oftentimes it was more special patrols, like we had a interagency law enforcement patrol that went down where the sheriff's department and state parks had some people from upstream somewhere and the park service and I don't know who else, maybe Fish and Game or something, all got together and went on a river trip together. And that was part of that getting to know each other and making sure we could work together and making those contacts and establishing that communications with other people. So I
mm-hmm.
would do that. We had a trip. I think we had a trip with outfitters. I can't remember very well. I would go on that. We had a great botanist named Tamara Nauman. I think it was N-A-U-M-A-N. who was pulling tamarisk out of along the river corridor. She worked hard to remove tons of tamarisk. She got a lot of volunteers to come in and pull out tamarisk. And over the course of maybe 10 or 15 years of just steadily chipping away at it, a lot of the tamarisk that was choking some of those river campsites was removed by Tamara, who worked under the resource management, chief of resource management. So it was a function of the resource management crew to be working on that. But I went out with her on a few patrols.
What else do you remember about her?
She was incredibly hardworking. She was very good at grant writing, so she would get grant because they didn't give her much of a budget. So she was more or less hired on as the botanist in the park, both to identify and protect endangered species or threatened species, but also to try and control invasive species. And she didn't have much of a budget, but she worked with local people to get a lot of volunteers to come down. So she worked cheap, and she also got grants to get tools and money to get tools, basically. And I think she even ended up buying her own river boats to accommodate volunteers who would go down to pull out the tamarisk. So she was great. I really admired her and liked her.
Yeah, for very good things about her.
Yeah.
And she was married, I think, to a park interpretive ranger.
Well, she's married to her husband's name is Pete, and he had a number of different jobs working in the park. But I don't believe that he was primarily interpretation. He would go out, and I'm trying to think of the different kinds of things. He was really good at going out in the backcountry and doing things.
Okay.
So I think he also worked for the chief of resource management doing some, I can't remember what kinds of projects, but working on some projects. But he would get hired for different kinds of jobs. She had the permanent job that continued for years and years and years, and he would pick up different projects. And
okay.
He was very good with backcountry kinds of things and a smart guy. But I don't think he worked in interpret. I don't know that he was overly fond of talking to tourists. So
okay.
I don't think he was an interpreter.
I probably have that wrong, but we did interface with him. He was very helpful, very friendly, very knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And I think he retired then.
Well, Tamara retired a year or two ago, and he probably also retired. I don't know that he had a permanent job. I think he was just seasonal on seasonal basis.
Okay.
Do you remember David Whitman?
No.
Okay. He was he was the chief of interpretation who had an interest in river stuff. So
Whitman?
Yes.
Okay.
He was there when I was there, so I thought maybe you had run across him somehow. But, yeah.
No. When did he leave? Do you remember?
No, I don't. I can't remember. I think he was still there when I left, which I left in 2001. I think he was still there then, but I don't remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so in the winter, mostly roving, and then in the summer doing some river trips, but mostly kind of coordinating
so
everybody else.
And
yeah.
Supervising and, yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else you remember about those summers or winters?
I mean, some of it just was joyful in the sense of that lonely, out in the west, on your own, early in the morning kind of day where I can remember going across the road north of headquarters. We'd go up to Harper's Corner Road. So you could drive up on the plateau behind the headquarters by going north out of the headquarters of Dinosaur.
Right.
And I think it was about 6,000 feet. No, it was a little higher up there. I think headquarters is about 6,000 feet. So you're probably up at 7,000 maybe feet up on this plateau. And you would drive north maybe 20 miles. And then there was an overlook there, but that's also nearby where the road would drop off to go down to the Yampa Bench.
Right.
Or you could continue down from there on down to Echo Park.
Right.
But I would go across that plateau, and there might be 4 inches of snow on the sage there. I saw a sage grouse once up there fly out, and there was just nobody else around because it'd be January 14th of some year, winter day. And I'd be looking around, and it'd be gorgeous, and I could pick up public radio from 3 different states.
Wow.
I could get Wyoming, I could get Utah, and I could get Colorado. So I had all these different programming options. So I would just be listening to the radio. Wyoming had some great music. Hmm. And going out, maybe, probably I'd head out there and drop down onto the Yampa Bench and then go east along the bench and come out east of the town of Dinosaur on that highway, which I forgot, which is that 40, maybe Highway 40, I guess. And then I'd circle. So that might be my whole day where I did that big loop, but it would start by driving north there. And It was just nice. Enjoyed it. So
would maintenance plow that road?
Yeah, I think they did.
Okay.
I think they did.
And then I'm assuming the Yampa Bench Road was, you're sort of on your own, or did they plow?
Yeah,
that
you
as
were
well?
On your own, and okay. Sometimes I can remember I would chain up on it because it would get mucky.
Right.
You know, the snow would melt and kind of get down into it, and it'd be these stretches of mud, and I'd be like, oh man, I don't want to go all the way back. I'm just going to put chains on it. It was a mess. But yeah, I don't remember. I don't think I ever got stuck out there, so that was good. But there was just nobody else around, and there's a certain loneliness that could come from that, but there's also a certain sense of really tranquility and peace that could come from just being the only one for miles out there in this beautiful landscape that's really quite natural, and that you're responsible for making sure nothing's awry on it, and you're just out there, and it was kind of cool. I enjoyed that.
Fun.
Yeah.
It is definitely a remote country that's not well visited. Not, it's visited some, but not like some of these other parks.
No. No, the quarry gets a lot of visitation. It's the bulk of the visitation. I don't even know what the percentages would be, but
right.
That backcountry of on the Colorado side, the rivers got, you know, were ribbons of visitor use.
Right.
But outside of those ribbons, there is just not a lot of people roaming around, and it was
right.
It was pretty nice.
Did you ever get into the country east of the monuments? Yampa arm into a place called Cross Mountain?
No, I think it was, I remember driving by the outlet of it, I think, as we would approach into Deer Park, I think you'd
right.
drive by, and I remember it was like class 4, maybe class 5.
It's challenging in there, yes.
Yeah, and I never did it, and
okay.
Did you do it?
No. You know, the history of people getting in trouble in there and succeeding in there, actually, way back. So the first person, people to run it really early on, surprising, they made it. But
yeah.
It's very technical, very challenging, very gorgeous.
Yeah.
The river just cuts right through this mountain, just kind of like Split Mountain, only the rapids are more technical and nonstop.
Yeah.
But I just wondered if you got over that.
No, I never got into there. I think it was,
okay.
I just thought, yeah, that must be on my, that's beyond what I can comfortably feel good about doing, so
yeah.
I didn't.
Do you remember who the Lador Ranger was when you were there?
When I was there, no, I don't remember the Lador Ranger, but we had seasonals, and it was nobody that you would know, I don't think.
Okay.
One of them, I can remember we had a fellow that we hired there, and he was just so ill. He was not a good fit up there.
Oh.
I think for some reason, maybe he had, when you have people who are veterans, they get extra points. And sometimes you hire them because on your listing of the available people for you to hire, you have to use an objective points, and you have to consider the top two candidates. I don't know why we ended up hiring him. It could be that he was on the top of the list, but he wasn't really well qualified to be there.
Okay.
But nevertheless, we hired him, and he both wasn't a boater, but he also wasn't really real good with people. I mean, he was okay, but he was just kind of awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would be talking to boaters about, because his job was to talk to boaters and make sure that they had a permit, and make sure that they had the required equipment. And
right.
There's a little campground there, and make sure that, you know, everything was okay up there. And he just was not a good, you know, he was the wrong person to be there.
Okay.
So I think he only lasted maybe part of a season a little bit, maybe the whole season, but he probably didn't come back the next year. So I think we had some seasonals. The first summer, there might have been someone who'd been there for a few years, but I can't remember who that would have been. It's only this guy that was not a good fit that stands out in my mind. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this is really interesting. People that interface with river runners, it's interesting. Think of park visitors who might come to the quarry for a few hours, take a tour maybe, and that's it. But the river people, like the backpacking people, spend 24 hours a day in the park or the monument, and they get to know the resource in a different way than the two-hour visitor to Grand Canyon National Park, millions of them every year.
Right.
And they, you know, they do need to interface with the Park Service and at a put-in where equipment is checked, and then at the takeout where there's oftentimes a ramp ranger trying to make sure that people don't spend too long on the ramp derigging their boats.
Right.
And that relationship is very important. So you got to have the right people there. Gee.
Yes, and sadly, it often is difficult to get people. I mean, ideally, you would have people who were river runners doing that because they would know exactly. They would talk the language, they would know the gear, they would know, they would be knowledgeable about what the river runners were going to be doing.
Right.
But there are very few people who are river runners who want to stand around a ramp all day, 5 days a week.
Swatting,
you know, they want to be on the river.
Swatting and biting deer flies
right.
and mosquitoes and,
So what you get is people at seasonal jobs, people who want to be working in a park, but they might not have the background that is best suited for that, but they can be a body, they can be a presence, they can be a set of eyes. Some pick up on things more so or have a personality that can interface well by them knowing less about what's going on than that visitor, the park, or the river rafter who knows more about the river stuff than the ranger does.
Right.
That was not uncommon at all, and it was always a difficult thing to try and to resolve, but there was no good resolution because you get a list of candidates that have applied for seasonal jobs at the park, and you have to pick the people who are rated out the highest on it by whatever merits, the testing, whatever it was that was used to come up with these lists. And you would get veterans, and I appreciate giving veterans opportunities because they have served for their country, and giving them a chance to get a paying job.
That's
great.
Right. That's right.
But oftentimes they were among the ones that weren't knowledgeable about the job at hand. And so, and it wasn't just the veterans. There was other people who would apply, and you just had to hire someone that was not the best suited person because they had higher numbers on the list.
Right.
We also would have volunteers. The Park Service is highly dependent on volunteers all over the Park Service for work getting done, whether it's in campgrounds with campground volunteers, at front desks with front desk volunteers, or like the takeout ramp at the bottom of Split Mountain where boaters take out. Oftentimes that's a volunteer who is working in the campground nearby maybe and spends a few hours in the afternoon trying to, or the morning when people are, whenever people are clogging up the ramp, trying to make some order and make sure there's room for everybody. And they aren't river people. They're just helping. And I can remember a friend of mine, I was on a private trip once, and got cranky with the volunteer who was trying to put order into this mass of people who were trying to take out.
Right.
And I'm like, he's volunteering for free to try and help.
Right.
Don't get mad at him.
Right.
He might not know everything, but he's trying to do his best to help out this situation. So, you know, the Park Service just had to do their best with the people they had. And
that's a big ramp and a busy place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the takeout. And everybody wants to get off the river just about this. They're camping in the same zone, and they get down there at the same time, and it just is,
You know, I wanted to ask you about an event that happened. It was before you were there. We had launched on at Deer Lodge, ran the Yampa, but we were going to go to Green River, Utah. So this was a long river trip, and we were going to go through Dinosaur National Monument and then out into the Uinta Basin.
Right.
And then through the Wildlife Refuge and the Indian Reservation, and then finally into a Desolation in Gray Canyons, and then to the takeout.
Yeah.
In that Green River.
A great trip.
Utah.
I thought about that myself. I haven't done it, but
What we ended up needing to do, though, was we had some people leaving and some people joining, and we needed to get some food at Split Mountain. And the signed campsite was 10 or 15 miles upstream from the takeout. And we had a lot to do that day, which was food and shuttles and this and that.
Right.
And so we went much closer to the takeout and camped on a sandbar, I think in Rainbow Park, and much closer than our assigned camp. And in the morning, first thing, a commercial company went by, and one of the guides said, "That's not a camp." And we said, "Do you want some coffee?" And they went right on by. And so when we got to the ramp, the Split Mountain ramp, there were law enforcement officers there that scurried us aside and wanted to see our permit and wanted to know where we'd camped and what we were doing, and basically moved us off to the mud downstream of the ramp and said we couldn't use the ramp because that was for takeouts. And so that's what we did. But it was a very uncomfortable exchange. It'd be difficult for the park, you know, trying to interface with people that are doing odd things, that aren't kind of following orders or following the regulations.
Right.
So I just kind of wondered what your thoughts were on those types of situations. I guess take it a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, you know, and the problem is that if you just start saying, okay, no problem, then people start being a little bit more abusive of that flexibility. That park chose to establish fixed campsites and assign people to those campsites. So as you know, different rivers operate in different ways. Sometimes they're, most often it seems like there are no fixed campsites and people camp wherever they end up at the end of the day.
Right.
But in Dinosaur, and you know what? The heritage from that rule might have been that Dinosaur was one of the very last parks to remove their outhouses. I don't know if you remember, but in the 80s, they had pit toilets at all these parks, all these campsites. So they did not get on the bandwagon of you have to have a portable toilet and carry it all out. They stuck with this, we'll dig some toilets, you can use those toilets, but you got to camp where the toilets are.
Right.
And so they had the assigned camping became the manor, which they used to manage their river there.
And that, so, that those fixed campsites were established in the 1950s.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but I knew that they'd been around for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't deviate from that in terms of letting people camp. They maintain that fixed campsite. And so I think that there's some flexibility if there's an empty campsite and you're
right.
launching, you can say, is there a chance we can camp here rather than there, and
mm-hmm.
they'll move you around. But
right.
once you get locked into it, and sometimes it makes for uncomfortable days because you'll have a real long day, and then you'll just have a four-mile day the next day because of the way the distribution of the campsites goes. There's, there's drawbacks with any manner of managing river camps that you
right.
come up with.
Yep.
And you ran into the drawback with the fixed campsite.
So it's really fascinating. And of course, I think the simple thing is to say, okay, well, if groups are indeed going out into the Uinta Basin, then they, we can revisit where people are camping so they can camp closer if they are doing
right.
exchange like that.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know whether your group tried to do something about the campsites before you got on the river, but once you're on the river, you're kind of locked into whatever.
It's too late then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's too late. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of just on that. Curious.
Some interfaces go better than others. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
you get someone at the bottom end that approaches you and understands and is empathetic, but might say, but you just can't do that.
Right.
And other people can be hard asses, and that's just the demeanor of the individual that speaks with you. And
right.
my belief is that the empathetic demeanor is better, but then also sometimes you get jaded to where you think people are taking advantage of little niches in rules, and sometimes you just kind of get mad that people keep taking advantage, not what you did in particular, but if you see, people parking in the no parking spot time after time, pretty soon
right.
it's like, whoever that 10th person is, you let them have it because it's like, there's no parking here. So some of it is buildup of frustration about other things. And, I don't know what happened at your takeout, but there's all kinds of ways that people get less patient and
I bet.
Aren't as,
I mean, I it's amazing because the employee stays there through the season, and hundreds of thousands or millions of visitors come and go. And to maintain one's sanity, cheerfulness, and equipoise, it's got to be really challenging. And some people make it, and some don't.
Yes, I think it's just some people have a personality that can do that more readily, and some people have personalities that are really good at doing other things, but maybe not being patient with. The same question over or the same issue over and over. So it just boils down to different individuals. And Anyway, that's an interesting story, Tom. Did you finish up, go all the way down to Green River?
We did, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
This was an amazing journey. And if you haven't done that Uinta Basin section, I'm assuming you have.
No, I haven't.
You should. It's 100 miles of flat water, but just gorgeous in its own way.
Yeah,
lots of oil wells and noise in the middle of the night, pump, 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 pump kind of thing.
Yeah.
But wildlife and just different.
When did you do that trip?
We've done it a couple times in the 1990s and then in the 2000s.
Okay.
Typically in the spring before the mosquitoes get bad, because the one time we did it in the summer, it was a mosquito nightmare.
Yeah.
Just, oh my. Well, this isn't my oral history. This is yours.
Yeah.
But I encourage you to go down there if you want to do it.
Yeah. And do you think that, did you notice differences in the oil well incursion into that basin between 90 and 2000, or was it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Lots more. Lots more. And we were up on the bench north of headquarters. Just a few years ago, Hazel and I were up there camping, and the lights at night out over the Uinta Basin, the mercury lights, just amazing. In the last 20 years, that area has seen some major changes there. Yeah.
Yeah, so I can't think of much else to add to my time in Dinosaur. It was wonderful country, wonderful rivers, not socially the best. Not that I had problems with anybody, it's just that there weren't that many people around.
Right.
It was a smaller community of Park Service people living in the housing area where I was, and there was not that much nearby that was of interest. So
And so how did it come to pass that you got to thinking, maybe I need to move on here?
Well, I can't remember. I think what happened was around the second or third year, I started realizing, okay, I've been a river district ranger in Dinosaur where I was, but also at Big Bend. And I think I thought, well, you know, it's time to do something more than that. I'm not really growing much here. I'm kind of doing the same thing. And I would have started applying for jobs. And honestly, again, I can't remember what jobs I applied for. But there would have come a time where I would have just thought, okay, time to start looking around.
And so I
ended up getting a job at Sequoia. I don't know where I might have applied and not gotten jobs, because I can't remember that now. But it was always the case that I would apply for this and for that and not get this and not get that, and then I'd get that. So I ended up applying for a job in Sequoia National. Well, Sequoia and Keaton's Canyon, which is adjacent, and they're in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. They're managed by one superintendent. They're managed under one chief ranger. And Sequoia has one district ranger for all of Sequoia, and Kings Canyon has a district ranger in law enforcement for all of Kings Canyon. And I applied for one of those two jobs. They were both open, the Sequoia and the Kings Canyon district rangers.
Okay.
And I ended up getting the Sequoia district ranger job, which was a big sort of jump for what I had been doing.
Yeah. You know, Pat, we've been going for about an hour here. I wonder if this is a good place to put a comma here, because there's going to be a lot happening in Sequoia.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait a minute, there's no rivers there.
Right. There's no rivers. It was a big change.
Big park, California, lots of visitors, Sierras, beautiful mountains, but oh my, really different from Dinosaur.
Right. And the job was a bigger job. And so this is a great place to stop, because I can, that was a big step for me. And We'll save it for next time.
Yeah. Okay. Before I wrap this up, is there anything else you want to add about Dinosaur before we say goodbye to...
No, I've had a few weeks to try and think about it since we last talked, and I can't think of anything else. I did want to mention that low water trip I did, which I started off with.
Really neat.
And other than that, it was, like I said, it was great to be able to see that resource in depth. And after 3 years, I was ready to do something beyond besides be a river ranger.
Cool. Okay, well, with that, this will conclude part 8, oral history interview with Pat Gradigan. And today is Monday, December 14th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. Pat, thank you so very much for this interview.
Yeah, you're sure welcome.